It's the Totally Football Show International Edition. Yes, road to Russia. And from England to Egypt, who we'll go out to in the last 16 thanks to a Dele Alli red card and the Henderson metatarsal, we've got it all rounded up like my height on a dating profile. There's good news for Three Lions supporters. They were folding early doors, but then superior wing play helped them enjoy new heights. That was the paper darts, of course. But not good news for Scotland, who become the first team ever to fail because they were using the wrong jeans. Elsewhere, we'll hear from happy fans in Iceland and the United States of America, and we'll rub our eyes and pinch ourselves once again as we ask, are they really going to have a World Cup without Argentina? That and your questions. It is the Totally Football Show. And hello, Raphael Honigstein on this Totally Football Show.
Hello, James.
Hey there, are you refreshed?
I am refreshed, thank you very much.
Okay.
I love the international break.
Yeah, me too. Some international breaks maybe are a little bit of a kind of handbrake on the exciting forward momentum of club football and its narrative. But this, I think, has been very, very exciting, full of do-or-die antics and all sorts of daring-do. I put it to you, Jack Lang. And it hasn't finished yet, has it?
No, still plenty to come in many continents, so...
Ecuador, Argentina. You were urging us to stay up for Peru, Argentina when last we spoke. I didn't myself. Did I miss much?
You didn't miss any goals, but you missed a very dramatic evening, and I'm sure there'll be more of the same.
Absolutely. Messi poised on the brink of missing out on the next World Cup. It's Michael Cox.
Hello, James.
Hello there. You've been busy this weekend, haven't you?
Just watching football. Two very comfortable victories for England.
It's what you do. Nice. International break then. For some... It sounded like this.
Brian el centro, Brian el centro, cabezazo, el mundial, el mundial, el mundial, el mundial, el mundial, el mundial. Así lo grita el país, así lo grita el país.
Mohamed Salah, Mohamed Salah. Wapa! Allah! Allah! Allah ya blada Allah.
But for others, like this. That's right, Scotland didn't make it to the World Cup. Just like Jim Burt warned us, Jack, it's the hope that does you. And there was plenty of hope here, wasn't there, for Gordon Strachan's crew?
Yes and no. I mean, when they took the lead, people had, I guess, hope that there'd be another 1-0 win. Strachan's made a habit of winning these kind of games, 1-0, 12, 1-0 wins as Scotland manager. An exquisite finish from Lee Griffiths, really, really was. If you haven't seen it, I recommend you finding it somewhere legal. A lovely finished ball coming over his shoulder. Amazing technique, really. So at that point, yeah, sure, there was a bit of hope, but the performance was not great. Even when they were ahead, Slovenia were creating a lot of chances. Scotland looked a little bit stodgy, I think. Chris Martin got the nod up front, but didn't do a great deal. And Slovenia changed things up at half-time. They put on Roman Bezjak. The game just started slipping out of Scotland's fingers, really. They were never really dominant in possession. They weren't creating a lot of chances. So I think if you're 1-0 up, you have to defend impeccably to get a result in a game like that. And they did not.
They certainly didn't, did they? Do you think nerves got to them, particularly the second Slovenia goal?
Perhaps. I think, well, they were both set pieces. They were both, I think, situations that Strachan might have expected his team to deal with. Neither was a particularly great goal. And the reaction to the Scotland players after the second, kind of heads in hands, really did tell the story. It wasn't pretty from either side, really. Slovenia aren't a superb side, but Scotland, even when they needed a goal in response at the end,
There was once again hope, wasn't there? It was Snodgrass, a very well-taken equaliser.
Yeah, it was a very nice finish. And actually, that actually very easily could have been the winner because Darren Fletcher missed a sitter a couple of minutes before that. And then afterwards, it was just left for another post-mortem from that set-piece defending and Strachan's memorable... reference to the genetics of the Scotland squad.
Yeah, absolutely. A nation that size trying to succeed against the freakishly outsized Slovenians are always going to be on a hiding to nothing. This is what he said.
Genetically, we're behind. In the last campaign, we were the second smallest, apart from Spain. So that means we have to pick a team tonight that kind of try and combat the height and strength. Even at that, we couldn't combat their height and strength at set plays. So genetically, we have to work at things. I don't know, we get big women and men together, see what we can do. But is a problem for us, because we have to fight harder for every ball and jump higher than anybody else because it's easier for these kind of guys.
Is it a question of genetics, I wonder? Or is it a question of nurture and nutrition and less lack of sun?
I don't know, Ref. These are valid questions. In the last campaign, we were the second smallest squad behind Spain, who notoriously really struggle at international level as well.
And also, who are the tallest nation in Europe on average?
You sound like you know.
I'd say Norway.
No.
England?
No.
Finland?
No, it's Holland. Who are not doing particularly well at international level last time I checked.
Genetically ahead.
Scotland's FA had to negotiate with the Slovenians to allow their supporters to bring bagpipes, this is true, into the stadium. But even if they hadn't, they would have had a small windbag who, when faced with a hard press, would emit a strange, but for some people, comforting noise. What do you make of it, Jack?
The quote, "You can't change our genetics." I mean, there might be a point there that Scotland are small and he wants them bigger to defend set pieces. The other phrase I've seen quoted, genetically we have to work at things, which smacks of weird management speak and slight surfeit of ambition, I think.
Or a really ambitious programme by the Scottish FA. Andy McNeil just tweeted us a picture of Andy Murray, which, you know, genetically big, impressive, best in the world, all that kind of thing. How does this rank, Rafa, among the greatest excuses in football? I always think of Walter Mazzari blaming the rain for Inter losing to Verona, who presumably had umbrellas or something. Other famous footballing excuses include, do you remember Ukraine defender Vladislav Vashuk after his side got beaten 4-0 by Spain at the 2006 World Cup? He said it was because the players hadn't slept the night before because of the frogs croaking outside their hotel. Do you have a favourite excuse?
Bertie Fogg to 98, Germany beaten 3-0 by Croatia, said that there was an international conspiracy against Germany because they had been so successful in the past that forces had conspired to peg them down a level or two.
Right. Mourinho-esque, that. Michael, were you about to leap in with a favourite footballing excuse?
Oh, just the classic one, I think, is the United grey shirts at Southampton. Although they're 3-0 down at half-time and then changed to blue and white and won the second half 1-0, so maybe he had a point.
Perhaps so. Perhaps one man's excuse is actually just another man thinking outside the box.
Yeah.
Scotland very much staying at home then. They're staying home. Scotland staying home is indeed what the England fans were singing in Vilnius as they celebrated their triumphant passage to Russia. You enjoyed these two games, did you, Michael? How much do England fans really have to sing about, I ask you?
Yeah, the games weren't enjoyable. I mean, they got the job done twice in slightly unconvincing circumstances. Two goals from Harry Kane, and I think probably that's what England are going to have to look to, really. You look through that team, I don't think we've got any top-class performers with the exception of Kane, who, you know, increasingly is being talked about as, you know, rightly so, as one of the best goal scorers in Europe. But England have got a very good record in qualification. I mean, since the failure in 2008, we've qualified every time, and we've only lost one game, and that game was so irrelevant, I don't know if you remember it, James, that it wasn't shown on TV. And it was shown on internet only with the presenter called James Richardson.
That's right. That was so funny. Do you know who the pundit was?
It was Mr. Sven-Goran Eriksson.
It certainly was. Did you watch that then? No.
Yeah, that was the viewing figure.
So ahead of your time then.
Really?
James.
Yeah, just internet only. No, but I did go back and, because I thought it was that game, and I went back and I read some reviews of the performance. They were more critical of Sven than England or you, if that helps.
Right.
James Richardson, not as bad as England.
Not as bad as England. England, though, to be fair, are pretty bad. As a pair of games, some people calling it some of the worst England performances or least inspiring they'd ever seen. What do you think?
I think that's a little bit much. I think the funny thing about that game was Slovenia had to win. So I think it was slightly surprising how deep they sat. And England, who were content with the draw, didn't really have to force the issue. So there was a little bit of, you know, is it worth England going for it? That said, I do think that they lack the tools to break down a deep defence, and I think they rely a little bit too much on Adam Lallana to just basically get good passing combinations going. I think the second game against Lithuania was slightly different. England played a back three for the first time in a competitive game for about 10 years, which I think is probably the plan for the World Cup. Southgate intimated he was going to use it in the two friendlies against Germany and Brazil next month. I think there was also a positive because Harry Winks came into the side, and I think in an admittedly uncompetitive field was England's best performer. He's just a very intelligent player. Positionally, he's good. He uses the ball intelligently. He's the kind of player that will improve the team, and yet England fans will spend the next 10 years saying, but what does he actually do?
Yeah.
Like Owen Hargreaves and Michael Carrick and lots of other players we've overlooked. But that was more positive than the first game.
OK. In general, do you feel that Gareth Southgate has actually taken things up a level or two? Albion Smudge, for example, saying, is it just me that dreams of Gareth getting caught in a Big Sam-style sting?
There's almost no point having a go at Gareth Southgate. I mean, he barely wanted the job when he took it, when Allardyce was dismissed. I don't think anyone thinks that Southgate is a top-level manager, but he was the best appointment at that time, and I think it's probably worthwhile just persisting with him until the World Cup. But, yeah, I mean it's not an no one is arguing that Southgate is a top-level manager, but he's
a lovely chap, though.
Well, he's developing the team. He's bringing through youngsters. I think he's vaguely doing what he should be doing, considering he's a bit of an emergency appointment, really.
Nice. Plenty of positives, then, for England. All right, friendlies with Germany and Brazil coming up in November. Wales and Ireland are playing off tonight, ahead of the, you know, real playoffs and that, which will also feature Northern Ireland, of course, despite their loss in Norway, thanks to Scotland's defeat. They are definitely into November's do-or-die head-to-head qualifying set of matches. All right, here's a bit of music, and then we get on to the meaty stuff.
Every single day, millions of people go online to search for local businesses. The question is, though, does your small business show up? Well, when you create a website on WordPress.com, you make it easier for your customers to find you, to connect with you, to hear how you can help them. Your business needs an online home. It needs a WordPress.com website. You too can choose from hundreds of beautiful template designs and boost your visibility with WordPress's built-in search engine optimization and their social sharing tools. So don't mess around with that other web building company that you've been hearing about on every single podcast since the dawn of time. Get started today with 15% off any new plan you purchase. Just head to wordpress.com/football to create your website and find the plan that's right for you. That's wordpress.com/football for 15% off your brand new website. wordpress.com/football.
Here's a question. Anthony Abdul says, why can Rafa never return to Norwich? And then you've replied, Rafa, this is an urban myth. What's going on here?
I think I once told a story of going to Norwich to see Bayern play in the UEFA Cup when Norwich knocked out Bayern in that famous run they had, and suffering a bit of an unfortunate relapse. I had an open wound on my shin, which opened up again in the night I spent at the bed and breakfast, and I left this bed full of blood. And I probably told a story to the effect that I can't really show my face ever again in Norwich, but right. It's not a technical term or some kind of ban that's right. been put on me, to my knowledge.
It's all very Alan Partridge, that, isn't it?
Is it? He has bleeding shins? I don't know. Well, I missed that.
The famous bleeding foot.
Yeah. Oh, did he? I missed that one.
It's the opening anecdote in your first book, if I'm right in saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Bingo. Hey, speaking of books, Alex says the only page in Zonal Markings, The Mixer, with P before it, was 302. CFAX nod?
Yes, it was.
Did he get a prize?
Well, someone else has already spotted it, and it was fittingly someone who used to work for CFAX.
Brilliant.
Which I quite liked.
Okay, yeah. Nice one. Listeners, ask your folks about CFAX. They'll explain. David McNally, hey, this is a good question. If each league had to make a football team out of the current top division managers, which country would win? He reckons Serie A. I have to say, I don't know if Serie A would, but I think Italian. Now, is it the league that does it, or do you do a team based on a nationality's managers, in which case I think Italy would be doing really well.
Well, England wouldn't be.
Yeah.
So who have Italy?
Shakespeare in net, though, as David McNally points out.
Who have Italy got? Montella?
You've got Conte, you've got...
not just in Serie A, you mean?
Yeah, I'm thinking like okay, Italians right, yeah. who are first division managers, which I completely misunderstood the question, what he's actually saying, your first division managers, I mean, yeah, boy, that's going to take a bit of thinking. We'll get back to you on that, David. Did like the question, though. Mark Ridley, here's another notional one. If you could invent a country, in which continent would you place it to give you the best chance of progressing to these World Cup finals? That's Jack?
I've looked at this, and I think the answer will change when the World Cup expansion happens? And I think the answer is South America, because for the 2026 World Cup, 6 of 10 teams will qualify.
Right.
60%, obviously.
Will Argentina get to that one?
Well, it depends if Messi is still playing, I guess, hobbling around. But the other federations, obviously this is very rough, and you know a lot of South American teams are relatively good relative to teams in other federations, but UEFA will have 29% of teams will qualify. Oceania, 9% only, and the remaining federation, 17%. So
yeah, but it's not just the number of teams who go through, it's the teams that you're up against battling to be part of that percentage. But it's interesting that you say that South America will be the easiest group. At the moment, they're not, are they?
I think this edition is a slight outlier in that the quality hasn't been massively high.
We'll hear more about South American qualifying later on, because right now it's time to celebrate a team that is going through, despite being in a tough group containing Croatia, Ukraine and Turkey. And that's right, I'm talking about Iceland. Croatia's 1-1 draw at home to Finland means that Strahinja Oka, our boys, Michael, are going to be in Russia. And that's good news for Stefan Augustsson, who joins us now from Iceland. Hi, Stefan.
Hello.
Hello. What a weekend of emotions for you, eh?
Yeah, very fun weekend. I've been celebrating quite a lot, even though we aren't technically at the World Cup. I'm going to put my neck out there and say that we are going to the World Cup. I know it's risky, but that's at least how I feel.
What do you still need?
Well, it depends on other results. Croatia and Ukraine are playing tonight, so one of them will drop points. But we are top of the group, and a win tonight at home against Kosovo will send us to the World Cup.
Well, first of all, there was Croatia drawing at home to Finland, and then you guys went and beat Turkey away 3-0. Back when you guys qualified for the Euros, I think there was a certain amount of almost like a patronising reaction, or like well done to the plucky Icelanders. But this is now back-to-back major tournaments, and the result in Turkey just underlines how dangerous this team is. For anyone who just knows Gylfi Sigurdsson, who should they be watching out for?
Well, Gylfi is our best player, our main quality player. I wouldn't necessarily say he's our most important player. I would say our most important player is probably our captain, Aron Gunnarsson, who plays in the championship in England. He's our leader. He's, you know, marshalling the team. And I would say he's probably our most irreplaceable player. But the thing about Iceland, it's not a team built of one quality player or a superstar. We kind of had that 10 years ago when we had a bunch of semi-pro players who weren't technically gifted. And then we have Ida Johnson up front, who was trying to create everything himself. That's not the way the team is now. The team is strong, work ethic, determined group of players who are playing as a team. And that's why we've accomplished so much. I think you're right. It's not a fluke. We got to the Euros and people said, you know, oh, the Euros are expanding. That's why it's been easier for these small nations to get in. Is it ruining the Euros? Blah, 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 all this stuff. We, first of all, would have qualified without the expansion, but in the last three qualifying groups, we obviously went to the playoffs last time for the World Cup qualifying, where we lost to Croatia. Then we made it to the Euros, and now we're qualified for the World Cup, which is how I'm thinking about it. And Croatia is finishing beneath us, so a little bit of payback there.
Hello, Stefan. I was just wondering, is the final game a formality? Because it's at home to Kosovo, but looking at their results, they only lost 1-0 away to Croatia, only 2-0 away to Turkey. All those goals were in the second half. And the reverse fixture between Kosovo and Iceland was only a 2-1 win. So they may be more resilient than one might think. Is that fair?
I mean, it's completely fair. In international soccer, there's nothing's ever given. But after the game on Friday, I decided we have qualified for the World Cup. So I think we're going to win tonight. We were in a similar situation qualifying for the Euros last time, where we had a game against Kazakhstan at home and we needed to get at least a point to qualify. And it was a nervy 0-0 in the end. And it looked like the pressure kind of got to them. But the coaching staff and the players have been talking about how they've learned from that mistake, and they're going into this game very seriously. And, you know, Kosovo has 1 point in the group and we should be beating them. And if we can't do that, I guess we don't deserve to go to the World Cup. But it's not a formality, but I think the players are going to show up and really make us proud. And I mean, even Kosovo, you think of a Kosovo, you know, a country in Europe, it still has a population, what, 7 times bigger than Iceland? So it shouldn't be a formality.
Speaking of the Icelandic population, Stefan, are they getting a bit blasé? Has there been the same reaction to this weekend's events that we saw from when you qualified for the Euros?
I think people didn't expect this, but you're right. It hasn't been as crazy of a reaction as when we qualified for the Euros. That was obviously our first major tournament ever. No one expected that an Icelandic team could do this. You know, old people were crying. They never thought this would happen in their, you know, lifetimes. It was beautiful. I think this time it's just been more people have been in disbelief, because before the game on Friday, I mean, no one was expecting Croatia to drop points at home to Finland. No one was really expecting us to beat Turkey. People were saying maybe take a point, but the complete, you know, domination of that game and being in this situation, people are just kind of realizing what's going on, and well, there will definitely be celebration tonight.
Right.
Again, I hope. I know this. People will listen to this after the game, and maybe we lost, and then I'm an idiot, but that's at least how I fare.
Stefan, let's fingers crossed, hey? Not least because it'd be a fascinating rematch with England at Russia, eh?
Anyway, I hope. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll stand by to see what happens with Kosovo this evening. One of the other top stories this weekend, without question, were the Netherlands, unfortunately. And Jack M saying, anything funnier this international break than Advocaat laughing off a reporter's idea that Sweden might win 8-0? Did you see this press conference?
Yeah.
Poor chap. I mean, to recap, Luxembourg had just held France to a 0-0 draw. And it was always going to come down, it looked like, 2-goal difference for the Netherlands with Sweden. But, yeah, they won't win 8-0. What a stupid question that is. 8-0? Well, no, I don't believe that, says Dick Advocaat when asked by a Dutch reporter. And they promptly did just that. The 8th goal from Ole Toivonen, pretty special, no? Did you not see it?
Didn't see it, no.
Oh, it's really
beautiful,
nice.
Yeah.
Kind of things that's... was it Sunderland he was at?
Yes.
Briefly, yes.
Briefly.
Right, yeah, Dick Advocaat took him there. Yeah, anyway, he won't be taking Holland to the World Cup, and that's a big... shame. Spain, are through in that group. Italy went and got held to a 1-1 draw by Macedonia. They are definitely through, I think, to a playoff now, though, thanks to other results. And there's still some questions. A lot of people asking about Gianpiero Ventura's future, particularly with Ancelotti now in the market. I think, barring something absolutely extraordinary against Albania, this evening, that the FIGC will just plough on with Ventura until it's far too late to do anything about it. But we'll talk more about that on Thursday, perhaps, once that game's been played. Portugal and Switzerland have a huge match coming up. Portugal are sure of at least making the playoffs, but they're going to be at home on Tuesday to Switzerland. They're 3 points behind Switzerland. The Swiss have just beaten Hungary 5-2 in Basel, their 9th straight qualifying win. So they're doing pretty well. Rafa, Germany. A 5-1 win over Azerbaijan, wasn't it, this last one?
It was.
Yeah, and then previously the victory over Northern Ireland. I love that Leon Goretzka goal. You didn't seem that bothered about it.
No, it's a very nice goal.
Mm. Did you see this one, Michael?
No, sorry.
Tell him about it.
Well, the ball fell to him after a corner, and he was facing the wrong direction, so he improvised with a back heel. But the interesting thing about that one was that he kind of smashed it on the half volley. So rather than your regulation back heel, which kind of trickles in, this one really went high up, almost into the roof of the net, which made it look very good. I mean, Germany in the first half were a little bit shaky. You could see that very experimental 3-3-3-1 system that they were playing without any defensive wide players. It took a bit of time before it got going. But eventually, their sheer quality and the movement up front overwhelmed Azerbaijan. What was really interesting is that Germany, when they lost the ball, pressed really, really effectively. And of course, you know, Azerbaijan did not have the technical players to get out of that press and completely surrendered the ball immediately. And Germany looked pretty good. You know, Azerbaijan, of course, you have to make allowances for the quality or lack thereof of the opposition. But this was another encouraging performance for Löw, who almost seems to have the problem that everybody would love to have in his place, which is too many players to choose from. He will have a really hard time finding the right midfield combination, deciding who he wants to play up front, who his creative players will be. The only problem that he has is the fullback positions, where there's Joshua Kimmich on the right and no one really on the left, and also no natural backup for Kimmich, unless Benjamin Henrichs continues to improve at Leverkusen. But that's been Germany's Achilles heel for a long, long time now, ever since Philipp Lahm moved from the left to the right. There's been no one on the left who's anywhere near on the same level, with a possible exception of Marcel Schmelzer of Dortmund, but for some reason Löw just does not like him and just refuses to call him up again.
But you're still world champions, even with that Achilles heel. I noticed Mustafi went off. How serious is that injury?
It seems to be a pretty bad one. It seems to be a muscle tear of the worse sort. So it could be a couple of months if it's as bad as first reported.
Also injured this week on international duty, N'Golo Kanté in France's win over Bulgaria. And, of course, Marouane Fellaini, who did manage to get himself off the field and, I believe, away from the stadium. But they were talking about some kind of knee strain, which is going to keep him out of the massive fixture coming up when the Premier League returns this Saturday, Liverpool-Man United. Wilfred Lawrence says, who would each of the pod be calling favourites for the World Cup at this stage? Hard to look, says Wilfred, beyond Germany. And he agrees with you, Rafa, too much depth. Who would your favourite be, Jack?
Germany as well.
Right.
I think they have the mentality, having there's a comfort level that comes with having won recent tournaments that I think possibly reduces the pressure on the squad. I think if you look at the other people regarded as favourites, Belgium, some people, Spain, Brazil even, I think they'll all have a touch more pressure on them, and I think that will probably make a difference. I see Germany as having the most complete squad and the most settled structure, really.
Right, they've got the right genes, really, for this. Spain just too small, I suggest. Michael?
Yeah, I'd go for Spain, despite that weakness, actually.
Really?
I think some of the players coming through are going to take them to the next level, and I think it's almost a bit of a new generation now. They've obviously moved on from Xavi and Xabi Alonso after the last World Cup, and the likes of Koke and Marco Asensio. The way they destroyed Italy in Madrid last month was quite spectacular.
Certainly was. Germany then, Rafa. National side doing absolutely terrifically. What was it, 10 games? You've won them all. 43 goals scored. 4 goals conceded. Looking pretty good. Why is German club football, when it ventures beyond its borders, faring so disastrously by comparison?
Well, it's a question that a lot of people are asking themselves, and certainly Joachim Löw made a point of saying this is very worrying. Germany had, for the last few years, a better record in Europe than the Premier League, and now they've relinquished that, and they're worried in a way that Italy might even...
Well, Italy went above them in the UEFA coefficient.
For the year, yes, but we're talking about 5 years.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter so much anymore with the new Champions League format coming in, but it is an accurate reflection, I think, where German club football stands. What they suffer a little bit from, I think, is the openness of the league and the kind of lack of hierarchy that you have. You have Bayern and you have Dortmund, and then it's wide open, and you have teams like Leipzig and Hoffenheim who not only haven't played much in the top division at all, but are, of course, both in their first ever European campaigns, and you could see that cleverness, that kind of know-how to negotiate these trips is lacking a little bit. They're a little bit naive, they're a little bit weak when it comes to dealing with kind of unforeseen stuff. And
but Bayern and Dortmund, who do have experience?
Well, Bayern and Dortmund are you have to look at them individually, and Bayern and Dortmund are still belong to the top 10 teams in Europe. There's very little question about that. Bayern, with a bit of luck, can still challenge for the Champions League, albeit they're no longer quite on the level that they were a few years ago. Dortmund have a problem with coming up against Spurs and Real Madrid. That's not going to do much for your chances. I think they'll fare reasonably better against Apoel in the next couple of rounds. The same is probably true of Bayern, who got Celtic in the next 2 rounds. So it is a bit of a snapshot, but I think it does suggest that there is a problem, because there really shouldn't be a reason why Freiburg or Hertha fare as badly against the teams that they played against. They are despite, you know, not being the richest and the most prolific teams in terms of individual quality, should really have enough to get through the likes of Östersund and Domžale, I think, who knocked out Freiburg. So that is where I think the real criticism will come in.
Are people in Germany, though, pointing to this as a kind of sign of an incipient decline or something, or is it just regarded as an off-season?
It's hard to answer that. I think you have to almost go team by team. Certainly Bayern, there's very much a debate about their decline this year. And a wider debate, of course, whether they can continue to or come back to the same level without spending huge amounts of money.
Could they if they wanted to?
They could if they wanted to spend big money. They could if they wanted to gone and broke the bank and get Alexis Sanchez, but they refused to pay the kind of wages that he wanted. They refused to, I think, even think about spending 60 or 70 million euros on a player who was out of contract the next season. The question is, can they make up for that deficit by better coaching, by more togetherness, by mentality, by all these little things, tactics that you can influence that don't necessarily cost a lot of money? The answer is yes, potentially, but obviously not this season, because this is very much a damage limitation exercise with Jupp Heynckes coming in today. He was unveiled today as a makeshift caretaker, just to bring a bit of peace and tranquility into the club. And we're not even talking about the dressing room, we're talking about the people above him. So he's got a lot of work to do.
The how serious is the split? It's between what, Uli Hoeneß and
Karl-Heinz Rummenigge,
right?
It's pretty bad. I mean, they've never really seen eye to eye on many things, but they used to have this kind of power share agreement, despite all his problems, kind of managed to steer Bayern in the right direction. They would often frustrate themselves, but somehow, as a whole, they would make more right decisions than wrong ones. This particular time in history, there's a problem, because Uli Hoeneß has come back after his jail sentence and expected, I think, to take over where he left off. In the meantime, Karl-Heinz Rummenigge had gained more power, had gained a lot of respect as well for making some very pragmatic decisions. But crucially, he got the appointment of Ancelotti wrong. And now Hoeneß thinks now it's down to me to make the right appointment for the next coach. He very much pushed for Julian Nagelsmann. They couldn't do it for a number of reasons. And what Heinke's appointment allows them to do is just play a bit for time and really go for Nagelsmann in the summer, when it's be much more realistic, and also when I think Karl-Heinz Rummenigge will be more amenable, having contacted Thomas Tuchel as his preferred choice. And my understanding is that Tuchel turned Bayern down on the basis of not really having the backing of the whole.
Right, which is fair enough. Where will Tuchel go, do you think?
Well, Tuchel is waiting for a big job in the Premier League.
Oh, okay.
He's had offers below the top six. He feels he's done enough to warrant a crack at the very top. And we'll see if there is an opening. I mean, Chelsea, I think, by all accounts, we'll have to appoint somebody new in the summer. There have been, I think, preliminary talks going back all the way to the summer of this year in June, and that could be an option for him.
That's because supposedly Antonio Conte has decided that he's heading home. AJ Cortese, specifically for Honigstein, how promising is Schalke's McKinney right now?
Yeah, he's good.
Who's this?
He's a young American, Weston McKinney, who has looked quite good, actually. Schalke, because they're not really working as a team so well, I think it's harder for individuals to really shine and progress. And you can see that almost, you know, Goretzka is a much better player for Germany than Schalke, which is weird, because it should be the other way around, really. You should feel more confident and natural in your club environs. And, I mean, Weston has looked really, really good. Very, very quick. A super application, the kind of player that wants to learn. Different to Pulisic, but at the same time, I'd say you'd put them in the same bracket, because Pulisic has also, I think, shown himself so able and willing to improve his game and constantly learn and pick up new things. And early signs are that his compatriot might be doing the same.
Bingo. Speaking of Pulisic, and McKinney and young Americans. Very shortly, we're going to be hearing about how America turned their qualifying hopes around with that mighty 4-0 win over Panama. There'll also be all sorts of drama from Argentina and the like, and a brief appearance from Mia McIntosh. All after this. Listeners to footballing podcasts will know that there's enough tough decisions to make these days without having to worry about which razor to use. So why don't you take the hassle out of your shaving routine by signing up with our pals Cornerstone. Never run out of blades, never need to shop again. Just let them know how often you shave and they'll take care of the rest. Get £10 off your first order and find out more about your perfect shave box at cornerstone.co.uk/totally. Ian McIntosh, Tuesday marks the return of the Totally Football League show, which at least has got some League One and League Two action. Is that what you're going on?
Yeah, absolutely. We are welcoming to the studio one of my favourite ever people, Chris Powell.
Oh yeah, nice one.
Former Southend legend. Well, forever Southend legend. Yeah. But he's coming in because we're going to talk about Derby County. Mm. I'm just sat in the other room outside the studio now watching Derby County's 0-0 draw with Cardiff.
Bingo.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
All right, then. Excellent. So all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, we'll have that. We'll be looking at Accrington Stanley as well, because we sent Matt Stanger up there. And finally, we're going to be looking at Shrewsbury as well, who drew this weekend but remain resolutely top of League One.
Why? I cannot wait for all of that to be available for my ears. That'll be sometime on Tuesday afternoon. Bingo.
Good stuff.
Mm. Thanks, Ian. More international news from further afield. Two Africans now qualified. Did you know this, Rafa?
Yes.
Yes. Egypt, that's right. After 28 years, they're at the World Cup. Mo Salah with two goals in a 2-1 victory over Congo that takes Hector Cuper's team through to the tournament in Russia. Hector Cuper is the manager of Egypt. I must admit, that had escaped me. And terrific scenes in Cairo, wouldn't you say, Michael?
Yeah, fantastic scenes. And the interesting thing about the Egypt side is their goalkeeper, Essem El Hadary.
How old's he going to be?
He will be 45 when he starts and captains Egypt at next summer's tournament, which will break the record for the oldest player by 2 years from Farid Mondragon, who you might remember played for Colombia in 2014.
Right. Zoff famously winning the World Cup at the age of 40. I imagine that makes him the oldest World Cup winner.
I think you're right, yes. Yeah. And I think he took the record from the Italian goalkeeper from 34. I think
it'll be called like Sentimenti 4 or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who was Argentinian?
Most of them were. But anyway, nationality, it's a kind of an abstract construct. Yes. I put it to you, Rafa. Oh, Nigeria also through, as you mentioned. Alex Iwobi, who's just like, he's a goal machine now. Alex E. Wilby going to to Russia, or he won't be missing out. Either of those options work. CONCACAF. Mexico are through. Costa Rica have joined them in Russia. USA almost there. They moved up to third this weekend with a 4-0 win against Panama in Orlando Friday night. Now, they do still need a win in their final game to ensure qualification. But this is such a big result that we decided to speak a little bit earlier to our friend George Qureshi, the editor of US soccer quarterly Howler magazine, who was actually there in Orlando to watch it go down. This is what he said.
It was wonderful. People were here were very nervous about this match and qualifying in general. We were behind Panama in the table, and if they had won, they would have booked their ticket to Russia. And I don't know if you remember this, but 4 years ago, the U.S. Was playing Panama and needlessly put them out of the World Cup in the final minutes of that match. If we hadn't scored, Mexico would have stayed out, and you know, they're our biggest rival. So you know, they had reason to be up for this game, but man, we showed up and the U.S. played so well. I don't know. Everyone around me was pretty shocked that we won 4-0.
George, it's been a terrible campaign, mostly for the national team. Klinsmann sacked, Bruce Arena brought back in. Was this result, and more importantly, was this performance enough to make people think America can be great again?
It was. So I think people here, we were relatively sure that the U.S. would qualify. It's very hard not to qualify from CONCACAF. But the more concerning thing was how we were qualifying, and you know, we were just going to scrape through. And what does that mean for the World Cup next year? Were we going to be able to actually play nice soccer? And so, with Klinsmann and sometimes with Arena, we're used to seeing two holding midfielders, a pretty stodgy approach to the game. And in this match, Michael Bradley played as the sole holding midfielder, which allowed really their five players in the attack. times, and just the pace of the transitions. We scored a few goals off of counterattacks, which has been a mainstay of the American game for going back. I mean, if you think back to sort of the last high point, which was the 2009 Confederations Cup when we beat Spain, the world champion, and then almost beat Brazil in the final. These were fast teams that could turn from winning possession to scoring a goal very quickly, and this is what we were doing against Panama over and over again. That was really exciting to see, just the style that we did it in.
Well, a name that we often bring up in this podcast is Christian Pulisic. How good, George, do you think he is, and how big a star is he right now in the United States?
He's a very good player. We've had a series of promising young players here, going back all the way to Freddie Adu over a decade ago. But he's on a different level. He's playing for a real big team in Europe. He's very exciting, and I think one of the most promising things for us is that, you know, for Dortmund he plays on the wing. We've tried him out on the wing with the national team, and Bruce Arena played him in the center against Panama, and I think the consensus is building that that's his best position for us. And it's the place where he's going to be the most effective. And watching him pick up the ball and just go at, you know, two admittedly big and slow center backs for Panama still was extremely exciting, and something that, you know, we want to see going forward. Now, he's really penetrated here. The news program 60 Minutes did a segment on him last weekend. And so when I was driving my mother-in-law to the airport, she said, "Have you heard about this Christian Paulsen guy?" And proceeded to tell me his life story. So if she knows about Christian Pulisic, signs are that most people in the country do.
Okay, you've got Trinidad and Tobago coming up on Tuesday. A draw will still be enough to get you through, but I bet you're going to go for the big one, aren't you?
I think they'll win. They're extremely confident now. Trinidad has been the weakest team in the hexagonal so far. It's the last game. They're already eliminated. You know, that said, you know, Panama and Honduras, which are tied on points and both have a shot to make it above the U.S. And avoid the playoff against either Syria or Australia, they both have a shot to do that, but they're going to need to score a lot of goals in victories against stronger teams, Costa Rica and Mexico. So I think it looks pretty good for the U.S. I think the fans here are more interested in how we're qualifying rather than whether we do, because that seems pretty assured. So, you know, I think everyone here would like to see a strong performance and a big win.
George Qureshi, editor of the terrific Howler magazine. It looks good and smells good, that publication, Jack. Speaking of smelling good, why don't you tell us all about Ecuador-Argentina? This is Tuesday night, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Midnight 30 for the sleep fans.
Zero dark 30.
Exactly right. It's the second game in a week that looks like a must-win. The first one
was a must-win. They didn't win.
Well, it actually wasn't, it turns out. It felt like a must-win, but
okay,
it wasn't.
So last time you were in, you were saying you were going to have loads of coffee and stay up to watch. I think it started at 2 in the morning UK time, Argentina-Peru.
Well, I started at 9.30 UK time, okay, which handily got me out of the second half of the England match. So Bolivia-Brazil was first up, then the second half or 60 minutes of Venezuela v Uruguay, then Peru-Argentina, midnight 30. So right, it was in the end, it was about 3 o'clock bedtime. Number of goals I saw, 0.
You're kidding. In all that time?
Correct, yeah. There were goals happening elsewhere. In the other two games I didn't watch, there were 6 goals, but got a little bit unlucky. But it was actually a very absorbing evening.
Right. Okay, so Argentina drew 0-0.
Michael doesn't believe a word of that.
A 0-0 draw at home with Peru certainly was a newsworthy result. And now they must win this final qualifier in Ecuador to claim at least 5th spot, which would take them into that two-legged playoff against New Zealand. A couple of stats for you here. You're probably aware of this. Argentina have had 73 shots on goal since they last scored in the qualifiers. 73 shots. And it's a year, 12 months since anyone other than Leo Messi scored for Argentina.
Yeah, I mean, you think of, briefly touched on this last week, but you think of the strikers at their disposal. So we're talking Gonzalo Higuain, Mauro Icardi,
right,
Dybala, and then even down to like Lucas Prato and Dario Benedetto, who led the line last week. So good strikers on anyone's, by anyone's books. They don't lack for creators as well. You've got Messi setting up many chances. All of the strikers in qualifiers, 49 shots between them and just 3 goals. 2 for Prato, who's out for the moment. 1 for Higuain, who is not even called up. So that gives you a sense of how how lacking they are in cutting edge in the final third. And
well, it doesn't make any sense, Jack. Why are they not able? These are players who scored prolifically for their clubs, but put them in, and they got Messi behind them, put them in an Argentina shirt. You'd think it was everything was set up for this to be a goal-making factory.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing with Thursday night's game, a lot has been made about the possibility of Messi not going to the World Cup, and I think there's a bit of a straw man argument going on. People, a backlash against the Messi backlash, which I recently, at least, haven't really seen a Messi backlash. He was their best player by a country mile in that game. He set up plentiful chances for his teammates. So creatively, it's very one-dimensional in that everything has to go through Messi. And there were times he looked like he was playing defensive midfield. He was dropping so deep, and he really wasn't getting any help from what was supposed to be the other creative forces in the team. Angel Di Maria was appalling, taken off at halftime. Pepe Gomez, who I actually really like watching him in Italy, had a terrible, terrible game. Didn't really look like he knew where he was supposed to be playing. And there's just a lack of those kind of patterns, those... When Messi looks up, obviously at club level, he almost knows before he looks up where his teammates are going to be. There's none of that for Argentina, which means that up front, the ball isn't really worked into great positions if it's not Messi doing it himself with a bit of individual genius. So there were three chances that he set up, two for Benedetto, one with a gorgeous chip ball over the defence, another with a little reverse pass. Both wasted. One for Pablo Gomez, again Messi making it happen himself, dancing past a couple, feeding him through a lovely ball, again wasted. Messi himself had plenty of efforts, but they picked a bad day to face Peru. Peru were camped in their half most of the match, but they're very calm, so they seem to be well drilled. They know what they're doing, and in Pedro Galese, their goalkeeper, they had someone who was just having a great match. And the longer the game wore on, the less likely you thought Argentina were to score. Jorge Sampaoli, obviously a lot has been made of the attacking players, but I think he deserves a little bit of leeway because he's only just come, but his substitutions were fairly contrary. So Argentina ended a game they really needed to score in with both Icardi and Dybala still on the bench. Just changed his midfield, really. Fernando Gago came on somehow, still an international player. Very unluckily came off injured a few minutes later, really. Nasty knee injury. But then at that point he had the chance to, I don't know, take a bit of the initiative and make amends for that slightly defensive change by maybe putting on Dybala. But then he brings on Enzo Perez and the game just drifts away from Argentina.
Jack, the game in Ecuador will be played at high altitude.
2,900 metres.
Thank you, James. Ecuador at the same time have nothing to play for.
They've lost their previous five qualifying games.
Using up all my material.
How motivated will they be to knock out Argentina at the World Cup?
I think this actually is probably the biggest factor in Argentina's favour here. Ecuador not only on a miserable run of form, but after Thursday night's results, they lost in Chile, cannot qualify, nothing to play for. And really, Ecuador have been a problematic team in the past for what you might judge to be bigger nations. But at the moment, they're really in a poor bit of form. The squad is low on star power, to say the least, and yeah, lost five games in a row, like you say. And actually their record in Quito, which is usually very strong, has been not as dominant as usual. So Brazil, Colombia and Peru have all won there this qualifying campaign.
Argentina haven't won there in four visits.
Yeah, only three times ever as well, and only once since 1960, none of which bodes well, granted. But the fact that, I mean, Ecuador are in not a really good place. They will want to give a good account of themselves, I'm sure, in their final home qualifier. But it's not, on paper at least, it's not a team that should trouble Argentina. That said, many teams who on paper shouldn't have troubled Argentina have done so.
Yeah, that's true. What do you think? Are they going to win? Are Argentina going to get the win, Jack? Are they? Yay, nay?
I think if they...
Bang.
It will be... Perhaps by the skin of their teeth, that don't think it will be particularly pretty, but I think against a team low on confidence, they will maybe grind out a 1-0 victory.
Right. Just tell us, who do you think is going through from South America and who's going to get the playoff? So Brazil are already through.
Brazil through. Uruguay are all but mathematically through. They're fine. On both sets of results that I have. So I think Brazil will beat Chile. I think Uruguay will beat Bolivia.
Hmm.
I think Argentina will sneak a result in Ecuador. The one I'm not sure about is Peru-Colombia. So
right.
I think it will all come down to that. And in both sets of results I have, I think Paraguay will sneak into the playoff spot.
Really? With New Zealand? Can they beat New Zealand?
I think that's fairly touch and go. They're not a great team, but they really got themselves out of trouble in Colombia. Got Argentina into a lot of trouble. Two David Ospina mistakes for Colombia. Arsenal fans might be disappointed to hear. And I think Paraguay are actually the dark horse to sneak into the playoff spot at the expense of Chile and either Peru or Colombia.
Wow. Michael?
Yeah, there's so much focus upon Argentina, and that's reasonable considering they have Lionel Messi. But 2010, I think the funnest team at the tournament were Chile. 2014, I think the funnest team of the tournament were Colombia. And I think those two sides could be more of a loss than Argentina to the competition if they don't get through, especially because, you know, looking at Argentina at the moment, they've basically just got Messi. You know, I mean, they've got other players, but they're not playing well.
Yeah.
So it's just all about Messi, whereas I'd rather that you had teams that we don't really see, you know, from a four-year cycle to the next, being cohesive and attacking and entertaining rather than this kind of, I mean, the Argentina side isn't great. You look at the defence and midfield, it's not a.
To be fair,
it's not
Mark,
an attractive
it's a,
team.
It's a World Cup. I'm just going to enjoy it, whoever's there.
Well, yeah. But it'll be more. But remember that the last two tournaments have been criticised for being very defensive.
Yes.
And Chile and Colombia were two of the teams who did play attacking football. Argentina will not.
I think Chile would be a great loss. Just the collective football that they play. They've got so many lovely players. And yeah, I think they did themselves a big favour on Thursday by beating Ecuador, going from sixth to third, but I still think it might be the end of this generation.
All right, well, that's the end of our little South American run. We've got to move on. Although, here's a quick question. Can you tell us anything about how Ravel Morrison's getting on? It's not strictly South America, but for Liga MX side Atlas, I know he did score a wonder goal this Sunday.
Del Atlas! Morrison!
A little step over on the edge of the box and slammed a shot in at the near post. It's quite rare to see players that come from Europe, but especially England, playing in Mexico. André Pierre Gignac is the one who went from Marseille. There's also
Tigres.
Ena Valencia used to play for West Ham. And there's one English player who has played there before, and it is Antonio Pedroza, once of Crystal Palace.
Oh, right, OK. Fascinating. But Ravel Morrison, he's doing OK, is he?
I think he only joined a few days ago. I think that might have been his first start.
Right, OK. We're all up in that Liga MX here on the Totally Football Show. Listeners, have a bit of music, and then if you sent in a question and thinking, why didn't they ask that yet, it might be coming up after this.
Tweet us at The Totally Football Show, find us on Facebook, and check us out at thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Gary Robinson, hello. Check this out, AC Jimbo. He says, my hometown team, Chorley, and a stunner from Nick Horton from his own half. Goal of the weekend, Chorley. Did you see this?
No, I clearly haven't seen any of the goals I was meant to see. No, sorry.
This, basically, it was a stunner from Nick Horton from his own half.
Okay.
And, yeah, it was very impressive. Michael, you, of course, were seeing goals scored by Harrow at Kingstonian.
No, vice versa.
Oh, you were at Harrow and you saw Kingstonian beat them by 2-0.
No, not that vice versa. It was at Harrow, but Harrow won 2-0.
Bingo.
Yeah.
All right then. And how was that?
I mean, there's nothing much to say about it. It's a very bleak ground in the middle of nowhere, and it was a rubbish game. You know, it's everything that non-league is really about. It's not about
absolutely,
you know, having fun and flares you find at Clapton and loads of supporters you get at Dulwich. It's about, you know, rubbish football with no one watching.
It's kind great. Of about, well, it's kind of what, feeling that kind of Calvinistic need to suffer to feel better about yourself, or what?
Well, it makes you appreciate good football when you see it, I suppose.
All right, and you came home to the England game.
Yeah, unfortunately.
All right then. Also in non-league day news, of course, we were talking about the big grudge match at the old Spotted Dog Ground, Rafa, the oldest senior ground in London. Hackney Wick taking on Clapton FC, which saw the Clapton Ultras returned. They've been boycotting the ground all season. If you were listening on Thursday, you'll know all about this. They went back to the ground because it's also Hackney Wick's ground, because they were technically the away side. They felt able to go. And they helped their side to a 2-1 win, which has moved them up to 10th in A Division. Sir Alex Ferguson went to non-league day.
Football, yeah.
Hmm?
Hipster football.
Very, very much so. Even Sir Alex Ferguson's enjoying it. He went to Macclesfield to watch them beat Ebbsfleet United 1-0. I'll go to another question. Ed Quoth Raven says, who is everyone's favourite footballing Roy? Finally, we get this question. Rafa, who's your favourite footballing Roy? Come on. There's Roy Hodgson. There's Roy Keane.
Roy Naldo.
Roy Naldo, great shout.
Roy of the Rovers.
Absolutely.
Marco Royce.
Brian Roy. How about Brian Roy? Do you remember him? Dutch winger, played for Fodger. Nice. Okay, I'll move on to another
Roy,
one.
I'd say. Hmm? Van Nistelrooy.
Van Nistelrooy.
Leroy Sané.
Oh, Leroy Rosenia. We're on a roll now. A roll with Roy's. Yeah, a Roy's roll. Anyway, Guy Lewis, an imaginary billionaire, consults you about buying an English and a continental sleeping giant. Which clubs do you recommend that this imaginary billionaire buy and why?
That's a good one. I would say Hamburg.
Okay,
Hamburg,
why?
Hamburg SV. Because they have everything to be a huge, huge team, a huge club in Europe. Mm. They have the history, they have the fan base, they have the city, amazing stadium. But they have chaotic club leadership, bad finances. And they're punching so far below their weight that any half-decent person to come in with a bit of money could have achieved...
They're the Arsenal of Germany, basically. That's what you're saying.
No, much, much worse than the Arsenal.
I'm kidding, of course. They're the Newcastle of Germany.
Much worse than that.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, they haven't been relegated, but they're forever a byword for underachievement and lack of competence.
Right. Who would you recommend in England, then? Newcastle? I mean, they're the obvious ones.
I mean, Newcastle or Leeds, I guess, are the standard answers. I mean, Wolves, I guess, is being tried. Maybe that's the next one.
Tell you what, it's a question that we might dust off for this Thursday's Totally Football Show, because Dr. Tom Markham, who knows all about takeovers, will be joining us. You can trust him. He's a doctor. and here's another one. Hey, Des Holton says, does the pod know that Tony Watt, you know, who scored for Celtic against Barcelona, has a movie review website as well as playing football? Do you know what his website's called?
I think I saw the tweet. Is it What Watches? Or
What to Watch.
What to Watch.
What to Watch, yeah. Brilliant. It's a very nice-looking website, actually.
Have you looked at it?
I had a quick look, yeah. I went and had a look.
As a professional, fellow professional in that sphere...
I think you have to be paid for somebody to call you a professional.
Right.
So, still very much in the amateur ranks there. But
you are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very much so.
Did you see a few years ago where Leighton Baines had a music blog on Everton's website?
That's true. I've forgotten.
He was quite a good read, actually. Mm-hmm. And his form has dipped since he stopped doing his music blog. I don't know whether that's cause or effect.
On footballer websites, I don't think it exists anymore. But briefly, there was a wonderful, wonderful corner of the internet on which John Utaka had a series of pictures of himself. I mean, he'd obviously paid for props and for photographs, and they were not even sure how to describe them. They were kind of branding buzzwords like creativity, but they in the way that you choose some that are nouns and some that are verbs, so it's a bit messy, like creativity, trying, things like that. And with him just in a series of poses with a bow and arrow, dressed as a kind of middle-aged thinker, I'll try and dig it out.
That's
somehow.
That's brilliant. Yeah. Where can we find those?
I don't think you can.
Do you think they've all been deleted?
I'm sure the photos exist, but the website itself is no longer with us. But I'll do my best to dig out the photos.
All right. And listen, finally, talking of no longer with us, Frank Psychic says, how about a word or two on the passing of Italian broadcasting legend Aldo Biscardi? This probably means nothing to any of you. Is that right? Do you know Aldo Biscardi?
I know.
Even you, Italianophile that you are?
The guy with a moustache.
No. He's kind of the proto Donald Trump in so many ways. This is something we'll have to dust off for Thursday's pod with James, who I know will be deeply moved by Aldo Biscardi's passing. He basically hosted, he kind of is credited in Italy with inventing the whole genre of shows where you just sit around talking, or more accurately, shouting about football, and that's all you do. And he would be the kind of genial host with this ridiculous tan and orange hair, which is why I call him the proto-Donald Trump.
Because of his politics.
And also because they would talk utter nonsense for the entire course of the show, which was called the Monday Trial, Il Processo del Lunedì, which was an institution in Italy. And indeed, as Frank Sidekick points out, his temporary downfall came about because he was part of Luciano Moggi's kind of enclave. Moggi basically had journalists, players, managers, agents, everybody under his wing, and he could lean on them for, he could exert influence at any time to get the right spin, to try and help somebody's career and get a favour in return. And Biscardi was one of the people who, when they uncovered all the wiretaps, Biscardi was in there heavily, Rafa.
James, when you were there, did anyone ever lean on you?
Never.
No?
What was in those cakes, James?
Yeah. No, no. Sadly, I was entirely peripheral to the whole thing.
Got any expensive watches?
I'm afraid not.
All paid expenses.
No. But anyway, Biscardi, an utter institution, an unbearable program, and really quite the worst program ever made. But hopefully there's some of it out on YouTube, because it's worth there going to see. He sits there, basically, he'll provoke the entire storm by saying something inflammatory. Yeah. And then everybody, notably Maurizio Mosca, who was this kind of like unpleasant, short little man, who's also sadly passed away now, next to him, would just shout from either side of the studio at each other. And Biscardi would be there, kind of with his hands up, saying, calm down, everyone, calm down, with a big smile on his face. And that's basically how
Was this even a football show?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, that's the essence of football. I think I'm being fair, in Italy. So, yeah. We've got to go, and I bet you have too, listeners, unless you have already. We'll be back on Thursday with all sorts of things. Dr. Tom Markham will be with us, Julien Laurent and James Horncastle as well. And, of course, we'll be looking forward to big fixtures in the Premier League and beyond, with notably Man United visiting Liverpool. For today, many thanks to Michael Cox, to Jack Lang and to Raphael Honigstein for being with us. Have yourselves a fantastic finish to the International Week, and we'll see you Thursday.
The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.